This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's a new study out from an organization based here in the Midwest that says that Indiana needs to do more to protect its infrastructure from the extreme weather that the shifts in climate can create. It's an organization that has studied this for some time. The Midwest Economic Policy Institute is the one that has put out the reports on these issues and the impact on the infrastructure of climate changes and the impacts from climate change as well. And the person who is the transportation policy analyst that has been working on these reports is Mary Craighead. Mary is with the Midwest Economic Policy Institute, and she's the lead author of the study. She's joining us with us on the program today. Mary, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a little preface, if you will, on the importance of putting all this data together and linking it to the fact that we end up in one way or the other, whether we're taxpayers or just people who happen to use the transportation systems, we end up having to pay for the damage that climate control can cause.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we're focusing really on infrastructure here, and infrastructure is important. I mean, it impacts the lives of every resident, every employee, every business of Indiana and our region. And so it's important that we make sure that we keep it functioning and that it's actually being efficient and doing what it needs to do. So looking at climate change, particularly in the Midwest, I don't think people often think that it's really impacting us. You know, we look at the coast and see how it, how different events are impacting them or sea level rise. But it's also important to realize that it's impacting us here in the middle of the Midwest, just like it is elsewhere. And our report was really looking at what the trends have been over time, what we're looking at, what the future is going to be, and understanding what that impact really is. And what we came down to is really, I mean, the climate is changing. And so we're seeing a general trend of increase in precipitation, increase in temperature. So we need to start looking at what we can do to make sure we keep our infrastructure functioning well.
I noticed that the report also talks about the fact that we not only have rising temperatures on average, going back at least 50 years, but also, too, we see average rainfall across the Midwest, and Indiana in particular has been going up as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, average temperatures have risen, data showing specifically for Indiana, about 1 degree since the 1950s. It doesn't seem like a lot, but it still is in that general trend. And we're also seeing higher temperature increases, particularly in the winter. And then also, yeah, looking at precipitation, there's been an increase of around 8 to 10% for much of the state in precipitation annually.
When you take a look at the information, not only for the climatological data that you've gotten together to be able to put the report together too, but do you take a look at some other empirical data that maybe you get from localities talking about damage that was done? We'll say, for example, in South Lake County, we of course have the Kankakee River bordering Lake and in Newton counties, and the Kankakee River is prone to flooding a lot. And it seems like every year there is some neighborhood or areas, and particularly this last year, we were talking about earlier this year in 2018, it was particularly bad, where we had a number of neighborhoods that were affected in several counties along the Kankakee River because of the flooding. Now, that was due, of course, because of the rainfall. But here again, we're talking about more rains on the average, aren't we? And we're talking about the impact that it has. Did you get a chance to get some information from the Weather Service and maybe some of the county emergency management people to find out exactly what kind of damage was done? That in turn fits in together with what kind of damage it causes to the infrastructure.
Yeah, that was exactly something we were also looking into. And, you know, looking at kind of some of these major events that we've seen in the last 10 years, I mean, we can look back and, I mean, I think all of us remember the flooding in 2008. And then you flip around and we have the drought in 2012 that impacted much of the state. And then, you know, flooding again in 2015, that was in more central Indiana, was really impacted. But then up here, all of us can attest to the massive flooding that we had in late February and March, and exactly like you were saying, you know, not only was that impacting people's homes, but also roads were closed, damage was done. And yeah, that was something that we were also looking into. One thing that I guess just to point out is looking at the 2008 flood, it really blows my mind to imagine the fact that 8094 was actually closed down because of that flood for several days.
Oh, yeah.
Just seeing that impact and what that would ripple through to not only the rest of the region for the Midwest, but the nation. I mean, you had a lot of freight traffic and people who all of a sudden could not drive on this major interstate because of flooding. And that, I think that's just one of the prime examples of kind of what we're looking at here.
Now, we're talking about neighborhoods there, for example, in Munster, because it crosses, because 8094 crosses Munster, and it's also very close to the Little Calumet River, which actually flooded out their entire neighborhoods close to 8094 that had to close because of the flooding and just completely damaged some business areas right in that particular region. And it turned it it's something that may have happened years ago. We're talking about 10 years ago, but it's still, as you say, fresh enough in people's memories that they ought to remember these things can happen. You talk about the damage to roads and the bridges, but you also talk, too, in the report about damage to power lines and the electrical infrastructure. How does that fit in?
Yeah, so, you know, in the Midwest, it's really it's common around the state that we have transmission lines are above ground, and so that makes them particularly susceptible to high winds, to ice, snow, electrical storms, obviously. And as we're seeing an increase of these extreme storms passing through, that is obviously going to impact a lot of this electricity infrastructure. Similar to transportation, you know, we all depend on electricity systems and making sure they're functioning. I think all of us really enjoy our air conditioning in the summer, and some people are using electricity to power a lot of things and heat their homes even in the winter. So, you know, these are really vital systems. We're looking at, you know, over 5,100 miles of transmission, of high voltage transmission lines, 8,000 miles of low voltage throughout the state, and all of those are susceptible to these storms and the increase in the frequency of them.
We're talking with Mary Craighead, who is a transportation policy analyst with the Midwest Economic Policy Institute, and she's worked on a couple reports as the lead author that deal with the climate change that we're experiencing here in the Midwest and in Indiana in particular, and the toll that it can take on our infrastructure. We've talked about the flooded bridges and roads that are flooded, the damage from the flooding. We talk about the damage to electrical infrastructure because of extreme heat and cold. You talk also, too, about the cost of all of this damage that can be done. How does it turn out that the managers get to paid for to be able to get the repairs made? Or is it pretty much borne literally on the backs of the taxpayers or the residents of a community?
Yeah, that's largely, I think, what we're looking at here. You know, we've seen there's an increase in heat, and when you have an increase in heat, that can reduce the lifespan of pavements, add stress to different joints and materials for bridges and highways, cause buckling of roadways and railways, you know, all these impacts. And then you're also looking at flooding can weaken actual structural support or deteriorate soil that leads to erosion. All of this is just leading to increased maintenance costs over the long run, which are largely going to be paid for by the taxpayer. I mean, we don't even have enough money really to fund the transportation needs that we have. Indiana's doing a really great job of moving forward, and we've had some transportation bills that have moved that have really helped that. But, you know, there's a lot of maintenance that isn't being addressed as timely as it should be at this point. And if you're looking at the impacts of what climate change could have over, you know, the next several years, we're looking at just increased maintenance costs. And if we're not able to repair them, then we're also looking at this cost is going to be borne by taxpayers in terms of whether roads are being closed down because they're not being able to be maintained, or, you know, just having to drive on inferior roads because the maintenance isn't able to be addressed.
In the reports, you put together a range of recommendations. Let's go through the reports, if you will. Talk about some of these ideas that the reports mention that the state of Indiana and localities in particular should be doing to try to be better prepared for the climate changes and the impact on infrastructure, like we're talking about roads and bridges and power lines and the like. I know that one recommendation you make, it would be actually a statewide recommendation, which you're calling a climate action plan. Tell us about that.
So climate action plans have become somewhat common throughout the country. Several other states have adopted them. And this is, they're really just looking at what the risk is for the state and how we can lessen that risk in the future. So climate action plans are often dealing with actual mitigation strategies. So that's actually looking at what is believed to be the main cause of climate change and how can we actually curb that. So, you know, people have come out and it's been shown that greenhouse gas emissions are one of the leading causes of the heat trapping gases that leads to climate change. So climate action plans could lay out different greenhouse gas emission standards, helping to reduce those, or looking at clean power plans to actually reduce those, or building regulations to make buildings more efficient that could use less energy, leading to less of these emissions overall.
What are some other recommendations that you're making in the reports here, talking about not only adaptation to the climate change, but also maybe some making some changes to how these projects are happen to be handled for development as well as for infrastructure?
Yeah, so the mitigation is kind of the where you can start out with it. But like, you know, we've already talked about, we're already seeing some of these impacts. So we also really need to know how to adapt to them currently and adapt in the future. So there are a couple different ways that you can do that. One of those is looking at actual design standards for projects. So, you know, a road or a bridge is designed by using a variety of different, like, weather factors. So that could be whether what the average temperature is or what the temperature ranges are, what precipitation is anticipated, like flooding, velocity that impacts bridges and structures. And so if we start updating what these weather design standards are and updating them to current or what we're anticipating the weather to be, that would actually dictate the infrastructure being designed in a different way, whether it be a different type of pavement or a different thickness or the location of a foundation being in a different place. You know, some of these things that could actually be taken into account up front, which is really important because if you look at infrastructure, some infrastructure is designed to be there for, you know, it could have a design life up to 100 years. Some bridges have that. So, you know, if we're looking 100 years in the future, we're seeing much higher temperatures and higher precipitation, then maybe these bridges need to really take that into account to make sure that they're actually lasting the lifetime of what they were designed. Yeah, some of the other ways to look at it is looking at development regulations. So this is actually, you know, not locating something in an area that may be prone to flooding or prone to some of these impacts. And one example of this is actually in Columbus, Indiana, following the 2008 flood, which they were pretty badly impacted by. They actually created a like a flood review committee that actually reviewed all their development standards and updated what those standards were. So this is something that may not be common to everyone, but, you know, there are things called a 100-year flood plain. And so that identifies where the flooding would go in a 100-year period. And so they actually updated their standards to where people are regulated about development in a 500-year floodplain. So it's a much larger area accounting for bigger floods that they're experiencing and limiting what development can happen there or putting really strict standards on the type of development and how it can be built.
Now, Mary, I know a lot of your experience has been based by working with communities and organizations in planning and transportation and the like in various states. You came over to this job, I understand, from Victoria, Texas. Is Victoria, Texas one of these areas that has the possibility for flooding? Was it actually involved, unfortunately, in the floods in Texas here this last time?
Actually, Victoria was really hit by Hurricane Harvey most recently.
Yeah.
I wasn't living there at the time, so they had a lot of impact related to that. When I was still working for the city of Victoria and the Victoria MPO down there, we did have, there were several very large floods in Texas that were in 2015 and 2016, and Victoria was impacted by those. They had, we have a river that went right through the city that flooded several neighborhoods in different areas. Victoria is different because we don't have quite the extensive infrastructure as like what Northwest Indiana does. We don't have major interstates or anything like that going through. But yeah, these are things that in Victoria were certainly on the minds of everyone, and even throughout Texas, a lot of these factors are on the minds of planners and transportation policymakers and ensuring that they're being accounted for in the future.
Well, as you kind of draw the parallel between communities and problems that can happen, and even though communities are diverse, as you mentioned, the difference between the ones in Texas and the ones here in Northwest Indiana, still planners have all this common information, the things they store back in their minds to remember when they come across this data, that it's well worth looking into and knowing that there are some parallels. It just depends on what part of the country you live in.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, you know, climate change can impact really any part of the country. It's just a matter of what type of impact you're looking at. So it just so happens that where I have been living most recently, flooding has certainly been one of the major issues that has been common in both areas.
Well, finally, Mary, let me ask, with this report, or the reports actually that have been completed by the Institute, are they going to get sent on to officials in Indiana, like people with the state government, with NDOT, the transportation planners, so they can take a look at it and try and make some plans and changes accordingly?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly hope that the report is going to reach those folks and that we can get it passed over to them and that it could hopefully inspire some impact. We did recently just present at, it was the Indiana Society of Professional Engineers. They had a conference just this last Friday, and we actually presented our results there. So I was able to talk to a room full of engineers who are out there doing work on a daily basis. And we had a lot of receptive folks there. So, you know, we're hoping that as we're getting this information out, this is our goal for every report that we do, that we're just educating the public and educating lawmakers, and that hopefully that'll inspire some changes along the way.
Well, Mary, thank you very much for taking time to explain the reports and all of the ramifications that can come of it. And hopefully the recommendations will be ones that officials will take a look at when they look at the reports and make some changes to try to deal with the problems that they're going to face in dealing with the damage to infrastructure, whether it's the electrical system or whether it's roads or bridges affected by the climate change that we're facing around Northwest Indiana and certainly around the rest of the state. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Craighead is a transportation policy analyst. She is with the Midwest Economic Policy Institute. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time for another edition of Green Fleet Radio, and here is your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. Johnny Van Fleet. He's the head mechanic for the City of Hobart's Public Works Department. Johnny, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, you know, Johnny, we've worked with you for probably 6 or 7 years now, and, you know, we just really use you as the alternative fuel experts. And so we're just so proud of all the things that you've worked with to make Hobart really the green city. And
thank you.
So, you know, Hobart has embraced alternative fuels for years. So what sparked that interest?
Well, Lake County being part of, Hobart being a part of Lake County is a non-attachment area for air quality. And Hobart has wanted to improve air quality, what we can, where we can. So we explored alternative fuels, and that seemed to be one of the biggest creators of cleaner air.
Sure. You know, Johnny, as a head mechanic, you're more than a head mechanic. I mean, your title says it, but you're involved with so many things on making things operate and things fix. And I know a lot of times what happens is, you know, when we work with, folks that they're, you know, you've always embraced alternative fuels just because it was changed. It helped with air quality. But, what would you say to another fleet that potentially is engaging at looking at alternative fuels? Why did you embrace this so much?
Well, one, we're not afraid of change.
That's true.
You know, we'll try anything once. And as far as going with the alternative fuels, it just seemed the right direction, doing our part.
Absolutely. You know, working with the mayor, working from top to bottom, it's wonderful that you've not only embraced compressed natural gas, you've embraced electric, you're looking at other alternative fuels, you're looking at solar, you're looking at different things. And it's just so, enlightening to us to get to work with all the folks of Hobart, just because it's just fun, and it's you're like sponges, you're wanting to learn.
Yes.
And it's just been a great experience. So, you know, to all the listeners out there, if you want to learn and hear about some of the great things that Hobart's done, please get in touch with Johnny and the rest of the crew at the City of Hobart.
Absolutely. So, anytime.
So how many CNG vehicles or compressed natural gas vehicles do you have now, and how are they being used?
Right now we have 5 that are on the road that are being used. One is a sewer cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is a multitasking truck.
Sure.
It has a grapple claw that goes out and cleans up brush and whatnots, and it changes to a salt spreader, and then it could also haul dumpsters.
Mm-hmm.
We have a garbage truck that runs 5 days a week, picks up trash. We have 2 pickup trucks that the foremans drive.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 2 in the works to be retrofitted from diesel to natural gas. So, and then we plan to add 2 to 3 per year from now on.
Wonderful.
To expand the fleet. And we also have an electric vehicle that our event coordinator uses daily for her errands and stuff like that. So
I know the public works staff and the people driving the compressed natural gas vehicles say they prefer them to diesel. So what are you hearing from the staff about these vehicles?
The staff likes it because, one, the engine noise is hardly anything. Mm-hmm. And there's no smell.
Sure.
No smell, no black smoke, you know. Even like the kids at the bus stops, when they see the garbage truck go by, there's no poof of black smoke. Sure. It's cleaner air for everybody. And myself being a mechanic, maintenance intervals are longer, which is less tax dollars, and
everybody wins.
Easier to work on.
Yes. So we're talking to Mr. Johnny Van Fleet. He's the head mechanic for the City of Hobart's Public Works Department. And so, Johnny, we were with you in January when you did the ribbon cutting for your new compressed natural gas station and public works garage. Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about those two projects?
Well, the CNG station was needed by far. We got into this without the fuel station and had the trucks. Our trucks were traveling 30 miles round trip just to fuel. Mm-hmm. It was taking like an hour out of their day just to go fuel up at the end of the day and come back. Now that we have the fuel station on site, one, we're saving an hour of man time. Mm-hmm. Two, the trucks actually fuel up overnight while nobody's there. So you're even saving time and money there. As far as the new garage, state of the art. I mean, it is, it's beautiful. It's CNG compliant. We can work on the trucks inside. It's larger, so we can more steadily maintain our fleet.
No, and again, I think as you say, is that there's definitely opportunities for growth within the compressed natural gas market, and you know we look forward to working with on some upcoming opportunities. So, how does the use of the CNG vehicles and fuel help the residents of Hobart?
Well, the use of CNG vehicles helps the residents of Hobart because, one, the CNG emissions are close to none. Quiet running. They don't have to hear the loud diesels going down the roads in the morning, you know, first thing. And overall, just the cost.
Sure. And tell our listeners a little bit about that.
The cost, well, like right now, diesel's going for $2.75, $2.85 a gallon. Last week we computed it. I think we're paying 90 cents a gallon for CNG.
Sure, without any incentives.
Without any incentives.
Correct.
You know, and our garbage trucks have, the CNG garbage truck has double the fuel mileage as a diesel.
Now, all exciting stuff. So how can people learn more about the Hobart's alternative fuel vehicles and some of your green programs?
Well, at any time they can contact me, John Dubach, talk to any city employee. They'll touch on it. And South Shore Clean Cities has helped us produce a video that shows our part in clean air and clean water. And
well, Johnny, you know, in regards to your efforts, you know, we thank you for being that sponge, you know, being great to work with. And again, I know that that offer is there for any community, any organization that potentially is looking at moving towards alternative fuels. And, you know, we're just proud to say that we've partnered with you on this, and we're just excited about the future for not only for the City of Hobart, but for the residents of Hobart and Lake County. So
it's been fun.
That will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Johnny Van Fleet, head mechanic for the City of Hobart's Public Works Department. And I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you, everybody.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Green Fleet Radio, of course, every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking. And the podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Journalist and author Sam Quinones was in Indianapolis recently to talk about his acclaimed book, which is called Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. And the Methodist Hospital Task Force had hosted Quinones for his discussion. The book looks into the how and the why behind the opioid epidemic. It's been praised by the National Book Critics for its completeness and delving into the very, very serious topic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan had a chance to sit down with Sam Quinones to talk about the book.
You speak in the beginning about, you know, how this story really really grabbed you and you feel like you needed to do this book. Yes.
Right. I started the book really focusing on Mexican heroin traffickers, how drugs are trafficked. The DEA was saying they were seeing seizures increase at the border. I pretty early on collapsed onto one town in Mexico where everybody essentially came here, learned a system of selling heroin retail by the tenth of a gram or the gram, not very large doses, like pizza, selling it as in a pizza system. So basically, very similar to Pizza Delivery. So you'd call a number and they would arrange for a driver to drive the dope over to wherever you were. And this was a remarkable innovation in the underworld. That is a moment when another story is playing out that I didn't know anything about. I didn't know anything about healthcare or pain management or anything. And they hit the time when a revolution in pain management is underway in American medicine. Massive promotion of narcotic pain pills and opioid painkillers as the pretty much cure-all solution for everybody in large doses.
It's the perfect storm in many, many ways, and you're right. Able to get at that from a number of different angles, and you explore that through the eyes of, you know, these great characters that you've found as well.
Well, I found that in order to tell a story about a downer, depressing topic like heroin, nobody really wants to read about. You have to liven it. You have to give it a face. You have to make people part of the main focus of the story. And so I really spent a lot of time trying to find those stories.
Portsmouth, Ohio, a small town on the river, and the setting for Dreamland, a large, gigantic pool that is really a metaphor as you start the book. Why start there?
I started there because I thought that this was a story that was bigger than what I initially believed it to be, which is about drug marketing, drug trafficking, drug addiction. I have an entire book, and there's not one scene of someone shooting heroin into their vein. One reason for that is because it's a cliche. But also, I felt that the story was bigger than that. It was deeper than that. It was about community and how we have destroyed community in the country. And Dreamland Pool in the small town of Portsmouth, Ohio, on the Ohio River was a perfect example of what we'd done. It was this gorgeous civic center, civic plaza of a pool. Everybody kind of grew up. Their first romances were there. And then the Rust Belt Syndrome sets in about 1980. A lot of factories leave. Main Street hollows out famously, as we've seen in so many towns. Walmart pretty much sucks up all that. Finally, population diminishes, and finally they couldn't continue with the swimming pool, and they dig it up and replace it with a strip mall. And with that, you know, the town loses something essential to its existence, I thought.
And here in Indiana, we're not immune, and we're actually right on the pipeline, as you point out.
The first place they come to is Columbus, and this would be in the late 90s, this one group of guys. Which is a remarkable thing to me. They were the first one to figure out and then systematically exploit the coming market for heroin that the widespread prescribing of pain pills represented, was going to create. And after that, they figure that out in Columbus, then they just follow the pills. They go to Nashville, and from Nashville, my reporting shows, from Nashville, this group expanded like a market, a territorial kind of thing, like any corporation or sales force would do. They'd come up to Indianapolis in the early to mid 2000s and begin selling here. And they've really been here ever since.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
That is Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan talking with journalist and author Sam Quinones. Spring buyers for homes here in Northwest Indiana, for that matter across the state of Indiana, are facing even higher prices and fewer choices these days when it's time to look for a home. And there's a reason behind it all. And the latest RE/MAX Integra Midwest 2018 Market Trends Report is out and tells us more information about it. To find out more, let's check in with a broker associate for RE/MAX in LaPorte, Laura Konechny. Thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit here about this report. We've heard, of course, about RE/MAX, but we don't know how Integra Midwest seems to fit into it.
Certainly. Not unlike the whole nation, we are seeing a huge influx, not only in market prices increasing, but also, too, with a limited inventory for existing homes and home sales. So we have seen a very competitive and aggressive market, you know, this year in 2018, which has followed suit from most likely what we saw in 2017 as well. So this report reflects, you know, certainly the same. Home prices are up across the Tri-County, Lake LaPorte and Porter counties, with LaPorte seeing the largest increase of average home sales, up 33% from this time last year.
Now, how do the folks have managed to get the information together to be able to put this report together?
Through the MLSs, so the multiple listing services. All homes that are sold on the MLS are, all the data is sent down to corporate and, you know, downstate as well. So all that data is compiled from true sales that are documented from quarter to quarter.
Now, I know the information for Indiana shows that there's like about an 8% increase in the average price for a home that's sold around the state of Indiana, according to the report. And how does Northwest Indiana in particular, with the counties that are in the report, including Lake and Porter and LaPorte counties, how do they fit into this?
You know, in part for the course, we're seeing, you know, certain cities, Valparaiso has the highest average. They're up roughly 9%. As I alluded to earlier, LaPorte has seen the largest increase with 33% from this time last year. Mirabel is up about 10%, and even Gary is up around 9% from this time last year. So regardless of, you know, geographical borders, we are seeing, you know, a steady increase in the region, Northwest Indiana.
Now, we mentioned here at the start of our conversation about the fact that there are not only higher prices for homes being sold, but there are fewer choices as well. Tell us how the inventory seems to fit into all of this, both good, I guess, both good and bad.
Certainly. So, you know, it all depends. Right now, we're looking at it, it's a seller's market. The market is hot, and that is being driven by supply and demand. The limited inventory is also the major contributor to the increased sales prices as well. You're having a lot of qualified buyers out there, multiple buyers buying for the same property. So, you know, home sales, you know, the price points themselves, but then also to the competitive nature is driving up those home sales even further. You know, I attribute that mainly, like I stated, to supply and demand. The steady economy, also to the really low unemployment rates, you know, and then also to the financing rates. You know, while they've increased a little over the last 18 months, we're still, you know, pretty darn close to all-time lows, making qualified buyers being able to purchase more homes than they were able to, let's say, 5 years ago. And then also, too, this has had a good impact or a great impact on the luxury and vacation and second home markets. It's really demonstrating consumer confidence. So, you know, folks that are going in for the second homes and vacation homes, they probably always had this liquidity or ability to buy, but now they're gaining that confidence back in the markets, both stock market and housing market, to go out and spend the discretionary cash that they may have.
Now, we know that home builders are starting to pick up in some of their activities. I think they've been spurred on, I'm sure, by the fact that there are so few homes, existing homes, that are out there to be able to draw from. In fact, we just note here just recently that in the town of St. John, they're getting ready to plan for two fairly large housing complexes in that particular area. And there are more, of course, all across Northwest Indiana. How do the new constructions seem to fit in and into what you all get to work with, I guess, and be able to recommend to your clients?
Absolutely. So new construction is very integral in the continuation of the housing market. With limited inventory in the existing market, we need to lean heavily onto consumers, you know, contacting builders and builders even building spec homes in anticipation for, you know, the continuation of what we're seeing in the marketplace right now. Without the new construction, we're going to be hopelessly deadlocked, and where sellers are going to be afraid to sell because they won't have their next step, you know, where they're going to go to next.
Right.
If they're going out of state or, you know, going to other markets, that's one viable option. But oftentimes, people want to, you know, say where their roots are and either buy up or, you know, maybe downsize. So builders, home building is a key component in keeping the real estate market afloat.
I was wondering, in fact, you just kind of mentioned here about the fact that we have homeowners basically it's time for them maybe to move. I guess they're empty nesters, perhaps. They have family members that have left. They're looking for a smaller place to live, but they're having trouble, I'm sure, trying to find one. Even if they want to buy a new house, a smaller house, it's still going to be pretty difficult for a while, isn't it?
It is. So, you know, as we spoke, we need new construction to help keep us afloat. So folks will ask me all the time, do you see the inventory lining up? Do you think this is going to get better? You know, I think that we at least, we're about a good 3 to 5 years, maybe even 7 years out. You know, if we look at the average cycle of somebody, you know, staying in their home, right now, sellers and homeowners are forced to stay in their homes longer because they don't have their next step. You know, the next property that they're going to. So it will lighten up, but we need to continue to see that new construction to have that available inventory in the future.
Now, let me ask you, Laura, as a realtor with a REMAX there in LaPorte County, are you finding with the clients that you work with that many folks, besides, of course, getting somebody trying to sell a house, getting a lot of offers for that particular house, are you finding some clients are actually dropping any plans to have inspections requirements in order to be able to sell the house easier?
You know, we are seeing that. So, you know, it's not always the highest net offer is going to be the winner when it comes to a multiple offer situation. So, you know, some different ways that you could do that is reduce the amount of seller concessions or seller paid closing costs, reduce or eliminate those. Removing that contingency of the home inspection is another thing that we're seeing. I caution buyers out there from doing so. You know, mm-hmm. if you have a really keen eye or, you know, have a knowledge in the trade to know that, you know, a house is truly sound, that's kind of a big gamble, though. So you need to fully understand when you're waiving that right to an inspection what the ramifications are. And, you know, some sellers are going to look at it, you know, I feel like my home has been well maintained and everything's good, but there is still a risk associated with what could come up during a home inspection.
Yeah, that's
true.
And
this is unbeknownst to the seller. So, yes, we are seeing some buyers using that as a competitive advantage, you know, in multiple offers or just in the general offer writing process. Yeah.
Now, give me an idea from what you and your colleagues have figured out and what your bosses tell you, too, and what they've learned, how the market seems to be shaping up as we go now from the summer months into the fall. And we know things at some point slow down, usually at the end of the year or into the next year, I know, because of the weather. Are you seeing it's going to continue to be a very, very busy selling and buying time here in Northwest Indiana?
Absolutely, Chris. You know, I'm a big proponent, and when I speak to sellers, you know, especially in third, fourth, and first quarter, in my opinion, I don't think that there is a selling season anymore. Year-round in Northwest Indiana is where we're seeing it. So with the limited inventory and life events that always occur, regardless of the season, deaths, marriages, divorces, job transfers, things like that, it coupled with that limited inventory, I don't think that we're going to see much of a slowdown, if any.
We're talking with Laura Kaneshi, who is a broker associate for REMAX in LaPorte. The folks with REMAX and Integra Midwest have put out their 2018 market trends report. Gives us an idea about the latest housing data and trends in Indiana, and in particular here in Northwest Indiana. Laura, thanks for taking time to tell us about this report, how it fits into Northwest Indiana home buying and selling. And we appreciate the comments and hope we have a chance to talk with you again soon.
Very good. My pleasure. Thank you.
Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson had a chance to step into the national spotlight briefly yesterday. She was a guest on NPR's Here and Now. The mayor spoke with co-host Jeremy Hobson about the problems and about the positive points of the city of Gary, as well as offer her views about the impact of the Trump administration tariffs on steel as well as on aluminum. And here's the conversation that was aired right here on Lakeshore Public Radio yesterday afternoon.
Gary, Indiana, people may not know this, is a city that was actually created by the executives of U.S. Steel,
Gary,
a long time ago.
Absolutely, in 1906.
1906. Is it still a steel town today, would you say?
It is very much a steel town in that we house steel, U.S. Steel's flagship.
Gary Works.
In Gary, Indiana, the Gary Works operation. Uh-huh. And while at one point they employed 25,000 people at Gary Works, we are only employing 3,500 now because of the automation and because of the changes in the steel industry, it is still very much the largest employer in Gary, Indiana.
Do you expect them to add more jobs, or is 3,500 like kind of what you expect to see in the future?
My expectation is that there will likely not be more jobs added because of automation, because of the way that they make steel now. You just don't need as many people. But that has caused us to really diversify because, you know, not only did you have steel direct employment, but you had all of the related industries, the can companies, the bridge companies, the auto parts manufacturers. We don't have any of that now. And so we have been forced to diversify our economy.
But on the issue of steel, will the steel tariffs, do you think, from President Trump make a difference for you either positively or negatively?
I believe they will be positive for the steel industry, just steel alone. But there are so many other industries, things that are produced with foreign steel, even though they are made in America, where you might have a negative impact. But I think it will still be net positive.
So when you talk about diversifying the economy, a lot of mayors want to do that, especially those who are in places where the main industry has shrunk over the years. How do you do that?
So what we've done is we've capitalized on our major assets. And one of our biggest assets is our location. We are in the population center of North America, 30 miles from the third largest city. And so we are in the midst of four interstate highways, three Class A railways. And as a result of that, we've been able to really grow our logistics business. Six of the 10 largest trucking companies have terminals, significantly sized terminals in Gary, Indiana. We have a major yard for the Canadian National Railroad. And that has been one of our ways to pivot. We've just expanded our airport. We've just activated our Port Authority. And, of course, we have really capitalized on the traditional modes of transportation that are related to industry. And we're also growing our commuter rail line.
How long does it take to get from Gary into Chicago during rush hour?
35 minutes during rush
hour. To drive?
Yes.
And can you take a train in?
You can take a train in. And soon, that train from Gary into downtown Chicago will probably take closer to 30 minutes. So it will really encourage people. Right now, it's 55 minutes. There's a South Shore line. But we are now double tracking that line. And so it will reduce the time, not just from Gary to Chicago, but also from South Bend, because the line ends in South Bend.
Now, Chicago, as you say, third largest city in the country, but it's also a city that, unlike some of the other major cities in America, has actually been losing a little bit of population recently. Is that hurting you? Are Chicago's problems hurting you?
Actually, those the people who are leaving Chicago, both businesses and residents, many of them are coming to Gary.
Interesting.
So that is helping with our population because we've lost since 1970. We went from 180,000 people then. We are right at 80,000 now, and you know we are encouraging folks, largely retirees, those individuals who really are looking for a quieter, slower lifestyle to come to Gary, Indiana.
How do you change the perceptions about Gary? I was reading a quote from a Gary resident in the Guardian newspaper. This person said, "We used to be the murder capital of the U.S., but there's hardly anybody left to kill. We used to be the drug capital of the U.S., but for that you need money and there aren't jobs or things to steal here."
Well, certainly we've had challenges. There's no getting away from that, and we don't hide from it. But also, we have seen real progress with those challenges. We've created over 3,000 jobs in the city of Gary over the last 7 years during my tenure as mayor. We've been able to also increase the population, or at least reduce the reduction of the population. So we've not seen it decrease as quickly. And we believe that we will see an increase in our population in the 2020 census. And a lot of that has been a result of innovative programming like our Dollar House program. We were able to use a Bloomberg public art challenge to create a culinary art program that targets the creation of small businesses. And those things have grown. But, you know, when you get used to complaining, when you get accustomed to seeing things that you don't want to see in your city, sometimes you don't see the wins that are occurring.
You tried to lure Amazon.
We did.
And?
Well,
not in the finals, but
we're not in the finals, but we're close enough to one of the finalists. I think we will see some of the benefits of that, not just that.
If they go to Chicago.
If they go to Chicago.
When you put that out there for Amazon, did you offer them a lot of tax incentives to come to Gary?
Well, we were very fortunate that the state was supportive of our application. I would say as supportive of our application as they were as supportive of the application that was done in Indianapolis. And so there were some tax incentives, but the major offer we had was the ability to really provide land to them.
How much does what's happening in Washington impact you right now?
Well, it would be disingenuous to say that we are not at all impacted but by what's happening in Washington. But what we've also seen among mayors is that there has been this resiliency among mayors and in cities to say, if Washington won't address climate change, we will. If Washington doesn't want to create a comprehensive immigration reform, we will at least make our cities friendly to those individuals who have come to our country. If Washington won't effectively address gun policy, then we will be a voice for young people who are crying out for sensible gun laws.
Do you have any gun laws in Gary? City gun laws?
So we, because of home rule, are unable to pass gun laws, but we have one of the last pending lawsuits against gun manufacturers and bad apple gun dealers in the city of Gary, Indiana.
One more thing, Mayor, you are the first African-American female mayor in the state of Indiana.
I am.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I'll tell you, it doesn't mean a lot if I'm the first and the last, but it is certainly an honor and it's humbling to lead the way. But what I think it means most is to my daughter's generation, and she's 24, that they can be a mayor and they can lead a city in the state of Indiana. It also means to my mother's generation that their labor has not been in vain because what they have worked towards has now come to pass in that I hold the mayor's office.
That's Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson of Gary, Indiana. Mayor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us in the studio to answer your pet's questions in our segment, Ask Ollie. And the pet questions, by the way, are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney, and Ollie's responses are voiced by his woman-human, Victoria Voller. And Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, my family is in the market for a new pet. We're favoring adopting a cat or kitten since we work and the kids go to school. How do we go about choosing the right cat or kitten for us? Signed, the Hanover family from St. John, Indiana.
Dear St. John family, if you're looking for an Instagram celebrity like Snow the Cat, who can help his owner play and win at the famous shell game on the streets of Tokyo, you may not be in luck. Snow has an uncanny ability to identify which of the five rapidly shuffled cups hides a small plastic ball in this famous shell game. His Japanese owner posted a video of him staring intently at the moving cups before placing a paw on the right one every time. So forget Snow, that cat is already taken. but you may find a cat or kitten that is very special in its own unique way for you. Start by making the decision to adopt. There are many cats that need a good home, and they're waiting for you in shelters all over Northwest Indiana. To help you get started, I want you to consider 4 important questions before you bring in a new feline family member. First question, do you want a kitten or a cat? Kittens are adorable, curious, playful, and full of energy. They're not a good mix with young children who may be rough expressing their love. Also, you don't know what a kitten will grow up to look like, or you may or may not like its personality as an adult. Secondly, now ask yourself about personality. No two cats are alike. Some are very mellow and will tolerate almost any kind of handling, while others don't like being picked up at all. What about the coat? All cats have lovely fur coats. So do you want a long-haired cat that looks beautiful but you have to brush it, even though some don't like to be brushed? I have never met a cat that likes to be brushed. Or do you want a short-haired cat that may shed if not brushed? Fourth, can you give a home to a very special needs cat? There may be a cat that's older, deaf, blind, etc., but they can make wonderful companions. Their conditions will not affect the amount of love and pleasure they can give you. It just means an extra commitment to them from you. Finally, there's a fifth one. Do you have room for one more? The good news is that many cats can get along with other cats. Actually, most dogs can too. However, definitely not me. My woman human once tried to bring a cat home, and I behaved very badly. Dogs and cats can become best friends, but dogs with their high prey drive may chase the poor cat to its death. Or like me, eat their food, steal their little feather toys, and sleep in the special bed reserved just for them. I admit to you that I am obnoxious, and I was especially obnoxious when I drove that cat right out of our house. I do that very well. The Humane Society of Northwest Indiana has 2 mommy cats right now. Their names are Kahlua and Marla, and they have brand new litters of kittens. These kittens are domestic short hair and will be ready for adoption soon. Good luck, and if you find a cat like Snow, let me know, and we can take him to Four Winds Casino in New Buffalo, Michigan, just to see what he can do with slot machines. Your friend in fur, Ollie.
And if you have a question for your friend in fur, Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Chris Nolte. Tomorrow is Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we'll have from The Times, Dan Carton and Doug Ross, and Meredith Colias-Pete from The Post-Tribune. Hope you'll join us tomorrow.